Wow, what a rousing finish to Big Band, Broadway, and more here on WHFR Dearborn, WHFR.FM, the station making waves. It's time now for our public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. This is the new WHFR Journal for Friday, September the 17th, 2010. I am your host, Jay Koronick, and happy to have you with us today for local news and alternative views about Dearborn and the surrounding area. And you can't find anything like this anywhere else on your dial. We're honored today to have with us a special guest. Actually, two special guests are scheduled. Our first guest is a former academic dean here, my former boss. Can't fire me now, and that is Dr. Edward Chillen. So welcome to the new WHFR Journal, Ed. This is microphone check time. We do things on the air here. Tell us about, now you have, sort of like myself, you've opted to retire from the college after many, many long career, and you began in the English division, I know, when I think I was there at the time, or I just had moved over to the fine arts area, maybe, right before you joined, and were English division head for many years, and then on to academic dean. And folks, that position on campus is overall the what used to be known generically as the liberal arts curriculums at our college. We also have sort of a technical career-oriented program, too, which doesn't mean you can't get a career with a liberal arts degree. That's just totally wrong. I never liked the naming of that, like, oh, you can get careers if you go to that division, but yeah, oh, academic, forget it. No, absolutely not. And today there's a lot intermingling of classes and programs in both areas. It's just we have so many courses, we need still two divisions, I guess. So what did you, just a little reflection, Ed, how long were you with the college exactly? Because, again, my memory fails me at my age.
Well, thank you, Jay. I appreciate coming back on your show. And actually, I started at the college in 1981. I was an English instructor there. And it was 1987. I became what they would now call associate dean in English. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in 1981, you were still in the English division, if I
yes, that
recall
was just
correctly.
When, just when Fine Arts building was being built, and we sort of just took the speech people and the theater people with us because the facilities, of course, were in that building for those programs. And so we sort of had a little succession there, but we sort of floated around as a separate department for many years until they finally were able to get it organized under a separate division now called Fine Arts and Fitness.
Right.
See, English doesn't have that fitness
no,
thing.
No.
Too bad for you guys.
You're the most diversified division in the college, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, those fine arts people, they exercise. Yes, we do.
That's right.
Sometimes. Well, you have not been a stranger to the college, sort of like myself. We are here doing things for the college. In fact, it's amazing how many people that have retired in the last several years. When I went to the last retirement banquet affair honoring the retirees, the retirees don't seem to want to leave. It must be that good a place.
It is. I retired, it was about 5 years ago, and it was about 2 years ago now. I talked to the president of the college, Dr. Mee, asked me if I'd be interested in coming back on a part-time basis as her assistant, and it was an offer I couldn't refuse. So I am back part-time and in charge of special projects for her, and it's been it's been fun for me to do that.
And you continue, I assume, to be extremely active in the community. You were very active with the Dearborn Kiwanis, too. Still a member of that?
I am a member of that, and this is our peanut drive, too. So,
Okay.
I want to remind people to support the Kiwanis, which supports the community. Absolutely. In various ways.
When does that officially start? You go on the streets, don't you, for part of it?
We were on the street last week, but
really?
Our members are still looking for contributions. And every year we raise between $40,000 and $50,000. I believe we're number one in the country in terms of fundraising.
Well, it's so important,
And all that money goes back into local communities.
We love local. I mean, don't have to worry about administrative fees up
none.
In Washington, D.C. or something.
Absolutely, you know? None.
Well, great job that you've done for the college and helping WHFR with your time here and still staying active with Dr. Gail Mee, our president, who we had a full interview with just a couple weeks ago on the show. And she is a very, very, if I can say so while she's not here, a very competent administrator and wants to keep Henry Ford Community College moving forward. Sure, it's difficult times economically, but now more than ever, that phrase came from some other context, but now more than ever, education is the key to getting people back to work, I think, and moving them into new careers, perhaps, as needed. So, right. Well, you're here today especially to talk about one of our new career programs, which Dr. Mee briefly mentioned, and that is, and what do we have? At least, it's over 100 career and degree and certificate program. So it's a large amalgam of, but this is a new one. And tell us how technical communications, that new certificate program got started.
Okay. The title of the program is 21st Century Technical Communications.
Oh, the 21st century.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
It is a certificate program and it is a credit program. So those who complete it will be halfway toward an associate's degree at the college. What happened was back at the beginning of the year, the college was approached by AT&T, and they asked us to work with them to develop a program to train people in jobs in the future in the area of technical communications. This would be cable, phone, you know, what we think of now as bundling, where your phone, your TV service, mm-hmm. Your internet are all bundled in one package. And so we worked with them and a number of their affiliates. They sent us job lists of job competencies that they felt would be needed in future workers in this area.
Mm-hmm.
They were interested also in training people widely, not just in the technical area, but also in areas that we might consider soft skills. Marketing or customer service, communications, those areas as well.
So the program has more of a more job possibilities than just stringing lines on a phone pole.
That's correct.
Yeah.
This would be everything from people who work in customer service stores mm-hmm. to those who repair and install systems.
Mm-hmm.
So we took those competencies and developed a curriculum which had two tracks to it. Business concentration for those more interested in the marketing, selling, customer service area, and technical, where the emphasis was on the knowing the technology and working in repair. But the core includes both.
Mm-hmm.
We then had what we call the summit, where people from the affiliates and AT&T flew into Dearborn, and were here for a day and a half meeting. And we sat across the table from them. These are people who own these companies, work in them, training people for AT&T. And they gave us valuable feedback, face-to-face feedback, on the curriculum that we had developed. We then took their critique and their suggestions and refined the curriculum further. We added a track called the infrastructure concentration, which a student could pick, concentrates on installation, includes things like blueprint reading, project management, creative problem solving for putting these systems into new buildings. And so there are three tracks students can choose from.
So unlike some other programs, this is, well, actually it's very much like some of the new programs and the newly devised and restructured programs here at the college. It's if it's only going to be a certificate or a two-year program, and it's going to be valuable for people with jobs, they have to have a variety, a good basis of classes, both you might say theory and practice and technical and even academic. Right. This is really essential, even in a two-year program. And previously, like in the last millennium, as I like to say, when I started here, a tech program was just all technical. I mean, it was just equipment stuff, and that might have been enough. But in the future, well, you have to know computers, but you got to know the theory and the principles and how to communicate them to a wide variety of people, not just customers, but your own staff, too. So, this is a 31 credit hour certificate class. I assume that if someone went so-called full-time here at the college, they could complete this in a year.
That's correct. We started this fall. We have a few students who are now taking the first course. Mm-hmm. We expect students in this program to be some of them full-time, some of them part-time, who may already be in a career but want to go into a different one or upgrade their status.
People have already started some of the first classes in this program this fall?
Right.
So they're already up and rolling.
Some of the classes in this program we already had, of course. Mm-hmm. Some of them we created, we designed specifically for this program, the CNT 105 Network Infrastructure and 107 IT Essentials were developed as new courses, which are kind of introductory or entry-level courses for people in the program.
And, I have to ask this, too, because people are concerned. Will this definitely get them a job with AT&T?
No, there is no. Okay, I want to make it very clear.
Yeah, right, okay.
AT&T made it very clear that, this is not a guarantee of employment. However, if you look at the job descriptions that AT&T puts out, and recently there was a posting that they expected to hire over the country 2,000 workers in IT, and you look at the job description and you look at this curriculum, they line up. And that's because we had that direct input from people in the field. While there's, as I say, they are not guaranteed to go to AT&T or one of the affiliates, this is a certificate degree that they have themselves helped to design. Mm-hmm. And for the purpose of getting workers that are going to be needed in this field in the near future.
Now, since they helped design it with their suppliers and subcontractors or whatever, it still looks to me like, and I'm just guessing at this, that there will be, just like the course of basic electricity and so on, and contemporary selling, that this is going to be a valuable certificate to have, even if you don't try to work for AT&T, maybe Comcast and these other multimedia providers to home communications and internet, right?
Absolutely. This is not a degree that's specifically focused on one company.
Because if it was,
is a growing
and then
area.
They couldn't hire you, it wouldn't be much purpose
exactly.
in taking it. So
it's a growing area, and also, of course, the technical concentration, which has the CNT. The students who complete that track will be prepared to take the Cisco Certified Network test, which is a certification exam, and that is a gateway to all kinds of possibilities for employment in that general area.
Yeah, it sounds like an exciting program, and people are already, taking some of the initial courses. I assume that to find out more information, of course, one place or the other on the Henry Ford Community College website, it will talk about the 21st Century Technical Communication Certificate, right?
Right. The two people who are, we might call, point persons for this mm-hmm. are Todd Browning, who is the Cisco instructor and developed the new courses. And
famous film director from 1930s.
Oh, is that right? I have a feeling it's not the same.
He's famous for, I think it was Dracula.
So. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so.
Maybe it's an ancestor.
Different one. Maybe an ancestor.
And Elaine Sineski, who is the associate dean in the business division, and she helped with the marketing customer service side of this program. They are both on the website. If you go to the college website, there's a link on the front webpage.
Right on the homepage.
This program.
Oh boy. Okay.
And I believe that their numbers are listed there for further information.
Sure. Todd or Elaine. And again, the program, the certificate program, 21st Century Technical Communications, brand new, started this fall here at Henry Ford Community College, one of those, as if we had to say, 21st century.
yeah.
But it is, it's a different kind of tech than the olden days kind of tech. And so it's probably, I bet you really had quite a time trying to find a good name for this.
Well, we did talk extensively about that.
There used to be an AT&T program at one of our competitors, Schoolcraft, many years ago, and it was just called telephony. Hello?
Well, you know
that was just telephone-based, and telecommunications is already taken. Sorry, that's our big liberal arts program here.
Yes, so. You notice that CNT 105, subtitle of the course is IP telephony. So we do have telephony.
Of course, it's part of it. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves telephony when it works.
Right.
I made a joke to Dr. Mee that, of course, all of our graduates here from this fine, well-designed program, 21st century design folks, will be able to lower AT&T cost to the customer, right? We're making a promise about that. Our graduates are going to be innovative, Ed. You know, you're smiling here. But,
I will say this. They will be innovative.
Michigan, by the way, folks, it's not just AT&T in this area. You know, AT&T is the only... you might say multimedia, but cable phone company amalgam that has a state contract. So it may move into other markets all across the state and do things that the other cable companies right now can't. Of course, the reason the state gave them that franchise, which was passed on by our legislature a few years ago, was to give some competition to all the local cable operations and maybe lower costs. Hasn't worked out that way. And then let's not talk about the iPhone service issues. But and Ed's still smiling, I think. Come on, Ed. Okay. but AT&T, one of the major powerhouses, really coming together here to get good training, good instruction, a program that's really designed for not just what they need, but what the future career needs are of students moving into these areas. So thank you for all your help. I mean, I know you still golf, but, it's good that you came back and helped coordinate this. As a former academic dean, you know the value of well-designed programs and curriculum, and this is off and running now. So, folks,
yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Again, for more information, hfcc.edu, 21st Century Technical Communications. Look for Todd Browning or Elaine Sineski?
Yes, correct.
Right. And they'll be glad to help you out and give you more information. What's your next special project? Have they assigned you that?
Well, there are a number of things I'm working on, especially articulations with universities and seeking new articulations and renewing old ones. That's right. One thing that we're working on right now. So it's been exciting. This program was an exciting one to work on and to meet and work with all of these people from really around the country. They came in from around the country for our summit. For this.
Great.
And so it was exciting. I think it's a new paradigm also for developing programs.
Well, as they've said nationally too, even the Obama administration has admitted that community colleges are the key institution that can move forward quickly in new innovative ways. The four-year schools are there, they're great, but they just can't move that quickly with facilities and staff and many, many other issues. They'll catch up probably, but the point is we can be there and we can help this area. And so great job. Congratulations on this program. And we'll talk to you more in the future about the all these special projects coming up. So
thank you, Jay, very much.
Thanks for your time on the WHFR Journal today. We're going to listen to our friendly progressive commentator, Jim Hightower, a couple of important messages, and then we have a interview with a political candidate who's on the state of Michigan ballot for election in November. So stay tuned, but listen close. Jim Hightower, always insightful points about what's happening in our society.
At last, Obama is getting serious about America's jobs crisis, proposing a $50 billion effort to put Americans to work repairing our national infrastructure. Of course, congressional Republicans have responded, as they always do, petulantly shouting no and plopping their fat butts down in the middle of the legislative path to block progress. But Obama could take one symbolic step on his own that would create jobs for about a dozen American workers. It involves the construction of a memorial and statue of Martin Luther King Jr. on our National Mall. After all, King's historic 1963 March on Washington was about jobs and poverty. So why not have some of our highly skilled bricklayers and stonemasons who are now unemployed build this monument in honor of King's legacy? Seems sensible, but guess what? The quasi-governmental foundation overseeing the King Memorial Project doesn't seem to have much sense. It is importing 8 to 12 workers from, believe it or not, China to do this job. Why don't they just poke every out-of-work American in the eye with a sharp stick? As the Bricklayers Union said in exasperation, this is wrong, wrong, wrong. Well, sniffed a spokeswoman for the foundation, only the centerpiece of the memorial is outsourced to Chinese craft workers, so stop your griping. Ironically, that centerpiece is named the Stone of Hope. But apparently, no one at the foundation has any grasp of irony, so they are proceeding to obtain work visas to bring the Chinese into our nation's capital and construct King's Monument. Presumably, America's vast pool of jobless workers will be allowed to watch them. This is Jim Hightower saying, to join the bricklayers' protest of this insult, call the Martin Luther King Memorial Foundation and tell them to put Americans back to work. 202-737-5420.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Why do airline executives hate their customers? Not so very long ago, airlines boasted about flying the friendly skies. But that happy slogan has now been perverted into flying the abusive skies. For example, what does a ticket cost? The airlines won't come clean even on this basic question. We do know that stated ticket prices have been steadily rising with double-digit increases in the past year. But that price is merely the starting point for today's airline hucksters. The real gouging is in the frenzy of fees that airlines have invented, many of which are not even disclosed to us and most of which are simply unwarranted. Last year, airline fees totaled nearly $8 billion. A consumer subsidy siphoned right out of our pockets into the corporate coffers. Take the ticket change fee. If something comes up, forcing you to change a flight from the one you'd booked, you're hit with a service fee of $150. Plus, you must pay the difference if your new flight is priced higher, which it will be. What a ripoff! This rebooking service is done by computer, costing the airline more like $1.50 rather than $150. Also, notice that airlines themselves routinely cancel or delay flights, forcing us into inconvenient and thoroughly unpleasant travel changes. Yet, they don't pay us $150 for their changes. American Airlines, however, has generously offered to cut its rebooking fee in half if you pay a flexibility fee of $19 when you book your flight. Then, any changes you need to make later will only cost you $75. Yes, it's a fee to reduce your fee. This is Jim Hightower saying, these infuriating fees are unnecessary. Southwest Airlines, for example, refuses to charge for any service that's historically been free to customers, and Southwest is profitable.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
This is the new WHFR Journal, September 17th, 2010. And, you know, we do things a little differently here at WHFR. Making waves is our slogan, and we believe in trying to give you entertainment and information choices that the other stations don't offer you. During the primary campaign, we had relative unknowns, and they weren't even look like they had a majority of support. Virge Bonaro, Democrat, was on our show, as well as Rick Snyder. And by golly, I guess they got the WHFR bump, as they call it in the media business, and they went on to win that. And so now we're getting these all these candidates expecting that same bump. I don't know, that's going to be hard to follow. Last Friday, we talked to, and by the way, I'm mentioning these things, folks, because you can go back and listen to previous WHFR Journal shows on the website, whfr.fm. They're there. Just click on the appropriate date. Sorry, we don't have the headings listed for each show. But last week, which was September 10th, we had candidate for governor of Michigan, Harley Mickelson from the Green Party. And he said his whole campaign budget was $500, so it was a little hard to get the word out any other way, but thank you to WHFR for getting the word out. These are all the candidates we talk to, whether it's for state office or local office over the next month before November 2nd election. They're all people that you could vote for. They're all equal on the ballot, and you need to know what your choices are. There's a lot of different points of view and programs, and maybe this country needs to get out of what Ralph Nader says is the two-party gridlock. If you follow Lansing politics very much, you know it seemed to have been gridlock up there. It doesn't matter who is in the majority in the House or the Senate, or who was governor even, didn't seem to matter in this case. Not very much could get done, and if they even got a budget, it was 2 or 3 months later, which hurt our schools and educators, and the tax system is still, nobody knows exactly which way to go, and there's still going to be another massive debt that the state has to deal with next week. So something different here. First of all, we have a different political party than we've had before. Our special guest today is Scotty Bowman. That's B-O-M-A-N. Scotty is running for Secretary of State on the Libertarian Party ticket, as they say. And so welcome to WHFR, Scotty. Why don't you give our listeners, you have been on the show before, have been a candidate before, but Secretary of State and Libertarian Party, some of our other listeners may not know too much, but if you can give us a little history or background on the Libertarian Party, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, the Libertarian Party was founded in 1972, and it was basically composed of people who were, one, disenfranchised Barry Goldwater supporters who had departed the Republican Party because they thought they were taking a move toward big government policies, as well as a number of people who were fans of the writer and philosopher Ayn Rand, who had written a philosophy called Objectivism that had many conclusions similar to what ultimately became the Libertarian platform.
That was the book, The Fountainhead, that was her first novel that sort of had these principles in it. Then she went on to write essays and other things too.
Right. And then there was even a bigger one called Atlas Shrugged was even preachier on the issues and on the philosophy.
Well, some people got through those. Well, briefly describe then, what are the principles of the Libertarian Party? Are you left or right?
No. And
there you go. Keep listening, folks. This is a good story.
The basic principle is, and I could kind of sum it up in a phrase, is that, well, this is a phrase every libertarian agrees to when they join, much to the chagrin of a few that are uncomfortable with it, but it's that we do not advocate the initiation of force for social or political goals. Another take on that is to say that your life belongs to yourself and yourself only, and that everything else follows from that, and that in order to say your life belongs to yourself, you must also respect the lives of others and believe their lives belong to themselves as well. And from that, we can derive a belief in respecting other people's properties and respecting other people's persons. To say a person's life is their own means in the present they get to live their own life, so they get their own choice. That's their liberty. As far as respecting their life of the past, a person has saved up the labors of their past. That is their property. And then you've got the future. Well, their life and their future is their physical life, that if you physically take a person's life, you've denied them their future. You take their liberty, you deny their present. You take their property, you deny their past. Government, in contrast to that, is a coercive monopoly, and as such, is frequently involved in violating those rights that come from those basic principles. And so for that reason, we believe in keeping government at a very minimal level. We believe it can serve some functions that at least to a degree enhance those rights, such as protecting people from crimes against their person and crimes against their property.
And if I can just restate for our listeners then, so the Libertarian Party, it actually has many aspects that might be referred to as conservative as well as liberal in terms of their issues. So there's parts of both, and yet it's consistent on the principles you mentioned, which is basically the Constitution that we have now, strict sort of interpretation of the Constitution we have now, and which doesn't include the income tax, by the way. I mean, if you go back to the original, but also individual rights of people to associate and to make lifestyle choices for themselves that even, you know, Republicans would think that they have to legislate morality frequently. And even though they talk about limited government, I just heard this morning on National Public Radio, a couple of Republicans, well, we're the party of limited government. Well, gee, George W. Bush and the Bush and his dad and even Ronald Reagan said all those things, and it didn't work out that way. We had massive increases in governmental bureaucracy under the three of them. Not that Obama didn't have hasn't started things that also increased the scope of government, but I'm saying, who can we trust here? Why? How can we trust libertarians if they had a majority and can do things?
Well, you know, I put principle before party label, and I guess there is no guarantee you could.
Well, because always.
And you know, especially like you mentioned Reagan, I can't think of better libertarian speeches I could give than if I could echo the words of Ronald Reagan in many of my speeches. But having been someone who actually was an adult during the time of Reagan, he didn't do all the things that his philosophy said he should do. He was a very interventionist president. He used troops to kill people overseas in many cases where it was not necessary to kill those people. He supported huge growth in the scope of government on spending. He spoke against the Federal Reserve, but then he drove us deeper into debt, which basically is driven mainly by the Federal Reserve system. So he said one thing, and when he got there, he did another. I suppose the key is that we are running strictly based upon a philosophy of individual liberty, and there's really no other motive to be a libertarian than to support individual liberty. Whereas the Republicans and Democrats, a lot of times they'll try to paint themselves a certain way, but their main reason is to get elected, and that's their main purpose. In fact, if the state of Michigan Republican Party, for instance, does not even have a platform.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's how, you know, committed they are to the positions. What they have is a cluster of talking points that probably based upon focus groups and surveys that people, you know, you say big government now, people feel negatively. If you said it when Bush was president, maybe people would feel a little less negative about it because Bush was talking small government and doing the big government things people hated.
Present Wayne County Wayne County Commissioner, drains are part of it. Gary Warrenchuk is from this area, and he is a Democrat now, but he was a Republican. He did serve three terms in the legislature, and on his exit interview with me, he indicated, I said, what about political philosophy, and where do you stand? And he said, well, you know, it doesn't mean very much. It's really just how you're going to vote to help somebody else, and then they help you out. And whatever you think you can do, most of the time you try to do good, but it's a matter of scratching each other's back to get bills passed. And he said, there really isn't, this is the main quote of his at the end, really isn't a political philosophy, at least not for him as a Republican, and certainly not that he could tell among his fellow Republicans. So I think it sort of echoes what you're saying, too, that it is so pragmatic that principle is lost, that are important things to have. I mean, maybe sometimes you have to be pragmatic to get some things done, but you can't lose sight or participation in basic principles that you believe in that are fundamentally sound. And I think there's even an ethical or moral connection to the party platform of the Libertarian Party, which you don't always hear expressed so strongly anyway from the major two parties. And so it's worth a try, I guess, by all means. So, folks, by the way, we are talking. We're going to be with Scotty Bowman here for the next 20 minutes, talking today in the WHFR Journal, he's a Libertarian candidate for Secretary of State. Now, of course, there's a whole slate of Libertarian candidates. We don't want to say you're all alone out there and you pick Secretary of State this time. But Ken Proctor is governor, all the way down to local races. We have a Libertarian pretty much everywhere. I noticed the 3rd District State Senator, which is in this area, part of Wayne County, there's only a Republican Democrat there. But in most races, folks, you will see a Libertarian candidate, and they're all pretty consistent with espousing the principles that you talked about, because that's the whole idea, right?
Right. That's the whole point of running as a libertarian is really, I mean, I'll say it quite plainly, we are an ideology-based party. We're based upon promoting a particular philosophy, the philosophy of libertarianism, after which we're named. And a lot of times the competition between Democrats and Republicans reminds me more of going to a football game. Everyone agrees on how to play football, and everyone agrees on how to play football good. And the main thing is to get one group trying to do it better than the other. And with the Republicans and Democrats, what I see are two people trying to find different strategies to keep control of government. We'd like to get elected for the purpose of reducing government. So it's not like we're uninterested in being elected. We are interested in being elected, and occasionally some of us get elected. But that would be a bitter victory, almost a non-victory, to be elected and then just continue big government policies.
Scotty, let's get specific here. What are your qualifications for, other than the libertarianism philosophy, which you speak very clearly and plainly, but what are your specific qualifications for elected office, and in particular, the Secretary of State's office? Now, this is an administrative job, sort of different than a legislative job where you're playing with bills and votes in the House and the Senate. This is every day keeping licensing going for automobiles and so many, many other functions. So talk about your own background, your own skills, and maybe how you would do a libertarian version of Secretary of State.
Okay, well, as far as my own background, I do have a lot of experience being a candidate and running for office, and am very well-versed on the issues and well-read on my philosophy. The particular choice of selecting Secretary of State is largely motivated by what I see as a looming threat to our liberty and to our privacy. And that is an attempt to use state documents, state driver's licenses, state ID, as a tool to build a large international database, a database that could be used to track every citizen's movements and purchases, which ultimately, through a series of regulations, could require people to participate in this database in order to be able to buy or sell. Among the early indications of this threat, and it goes back to 2005, there's something passed called the Real ID Act. And a number of states have opted out, much to their credit. Michigan, to its credit and to Terry Lynn Land's credit, stayed out. However, at the same time, there were a number of memorandums of agreement by Secretary of State Land that opened the door to the Real ID Act being imposed after her term was up. And there's a 30-day window in which the next Secretary of State can choose to opt out of the Real ID Act, or participation becomes automatic. Furthermore, there's other efforts to kind of reboot the Real ID Act. For instance, there's something called the PASS Act that's being discussed in Washington, D.C., another effort to essentially segue state documents into a national ID card, a national database. They would still have the name of the state of Michigan on them, and people from Ohio would still have one with the state of Ohio mentioned on them, but essentially it would just be different, you know, colors, different packages for the same document, a national ID card. So I'm partially running to reject the Real ID Act, the PASS Act, and any other attempt that may arise in the future to make state documents into national ID cards. Now, one thing that already happened with Secretary Land in office is the so-called enhanced driver's license, which, among other features, contains an RFID chip. This chip can be detected remotely, though the strong detection ability is generally very close, maybe just a few meters away. But potentially, with the right equipment, one could extend that distance. And you could track people then based upon that chip, where they go, what they're doing. And if you have it in a driver's license, which one essentially has to carry to travel any place, or even a personal ID card if you want to be able to do transactions anywhere and be asked for ID, then essentially you're having all your movements being tracked. The big plus, the big selling point that's used to promote this is, oh, you can go and use it for a passport, to which my response is, I can use a passport as a passport. Mm-hmm. And a passport has the same requirements as this card. And so there's really no reason to have that duplication just from a practical standpoint. And a passport is legitimately a federal document and not a state document. Furthermore, I don't need to carry my passport when I'm traveling intrastate or interstate even. I only need it when I'm crossing the border, for instance, going to Windsor or something. So it reduces the amount of time I'm being tracked. So there is a difference.
Let me ask the question of people that disagree with that. It's sort of it's a usual criticism, maybe a slightly different spin, and that is, if you're not doing anything wrong, what problem would you have with the government knowing where you are at all times? Like, a lot of telephones have GPS in them, and there's apps that parents can track their kids that they give the GPS to, and so they know where they are. Of course, that's a private family thing. But if your phones have GPS in them, and I've seen this on CSI on TV, they could actually follow you by your phone too. Right? So, don't we already have that sort of? And what would be wrong with the government knowing where you go?
Well,
it's a tough question here, but it's a philosophical answer, really, or philosophical principle involved, right?
Yeah, and it's not even really a new question, because sure, technology makes it easier. It provides new tools by which your privacy can be invaded. However, the general notion of why allow people to have privacy if they're not doing anything wrong is an old idea, and it goes back to, for instance, the idea of search and seizure. Why not allow the police to just come in whenever they want and search your home if you're not doing anything wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one quick answer to that could be, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, then why do you want to be treated like a criminal? One thing. Because I do not, by the way, believe all the things I'm saying about privacy should apply to a person convicted of a violent crime or a crime against property. Those people are forfeiting their rights by violating the rights of others, and to protect the public, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, fine if you can track them. It might be, you know, people wear tethers, okay? There'd just be a lightweight tether. But why do you want to tether me if I haven't been convicted of a crime? Now, that's one part. The other part about what if I'm doing something wrong, why not, is you're giving a new power to the government. You're giving the government the power to be more totalitarian. I think another question might be, well, maybe you're not doing anything wrong. Can you count on the government not doing anything wrong? How much power do you want to give somebody else to control you? What objection do you have to someone pointing a gun at you all day long if you're not going to do anything to provoke them to shoot you? Mm-hmm. Why are you giving them that opportunity is really what I'm saying.
Yeah, already we have, I've encountered, anybody who uses the internet for a while and does shopping has encountered all these suggestions, and even Apple iTunes that I'm staring at here on our computer screen. At the Apple iTunes store, they have a program called Genius, and also a new one called Ping, and it sort of it tracks everything you do, music you play, music you download and buy, just like Amazon.com tracks the things you buy, and they make suggestions to you. Of course, they database all that stuff about you, which is, in a way, I don't necessarily want people to know that. First of all, they might misunderstand me, you know, because I bought a lot of books recently about automobiles, electric cars, in fact. Is that the car I'm going to buy? Am I electric car buyer? Actually, no, it didn't work out that way, as it turns out. But I'm just saying is that you can get really messed up assumptions about people from these kinds of things. Even Netflix, they had a big competition and I've rated something like 4,000 movies, a former film teacher for Netflix. They still can't make decent recommendations for me, okay? They still don't know me, even though 4,000 movies, I told them if I liked them or not. They still make recommendations, and I don't like any of their recommendations. So I'm very suspicious of these amalgamated databases. People should know that we as individuals are really quite different than each other. Luckily, we have language and some common courtesies and a few basic laws of interaction, you know, keep us from killing each other or getting too weird. But in fact, the excitement of being human is having all these differences within you that you can have the confidence, I think, to reshape and grow and innovate and help other people. I mean, you have that potential because you are significantly different at the core in the way that you do things, and therefore your contributions can be so important to the whole as long as you can, you know, dip into and maintain and express those individualisms.
Yeah.
How does that sound? I mean, I've just been totally frustrated with all this databasing. I mean, I don't know how not to do it if I want to buy a product. It's hard not to buy it on Amazon these days. Local stores don't seem to have the selection that I want, you know, or the quality in some cases, I'm sorry, even though I try to buy local. So, well, anyway, I'm just rambling here. Specifically with the Secretary of State's office, you talk about making government smaller. You going to close more Secretary of State offices if you were elected?
Oh, actually, I would like to see more Secretary of State's offices and less government. Now, how can you do that? Well, not far from here, I bought a car, and I found out, much to my surprise, that I didn't need to go to the Secretary of State's office to get my title. It wasn't really a title. I mean, it's like it's kind of a temporary title.
Transfer
because they have a lien on it.
Yeah. Oh well.
You know, finance plan. But I got in my registration and all that. You know, proof of insurance processed. Right, they could do all of that right there at the dealership.
Mm-hmm.
So certain Secretary of State duties have already been farmed out to private organizations. I could see a whole bunch of Secretary of State offices, and this would even help people in rural areas that work out of storefronts, where maybe somebody who's got, like, you know, you've heard of people have a general store and they have a little post office counter. They could have a Secretary of State counter.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be certified. They'd have to meet certain requirements.
Have
that
a
would
dedicated
make them
computer system, probably secure computer system. But.
And the people running things would have to be at least as trustworthy as anyone we'd hire at a branch office.
I see you're a resident of Detroit, right?
Got it. Yes.
Here in Dearborn, you may not know that at our Dearborn Police Department headquarters on Michigan Avenue, they have a little room. And of course, police departments often help with driver tests and driver licensing. And ours does, and I don't think they do license plates as such, but they've got that little office there, and now they're, and it's so wonderful, there's no waiting in lines. A lot of Secretary of State's office, since they have closed a few, if you have to go in and stand in line, it's more than an hour in both locations in Dearborn. It's more than an hour now, and they do have people working at the desk, but there's a lot of transactions. Everybody needs a car, and there's other licenses Secretary of State's office handles, too. Is it hunting licenses do they do, and...
I'm not aware
sure
of the
maybe
hunting
that,
list.
Well, anyway, I know that you can also sign up for, to donate your body parts and other things through that office. Dennis Reimer is here in the studio. Dennis, your mic wasn't on. Which one are you talking on?
I'm talking on the one you have on.
Okay, right there. Right, okay. Go ahead.
I just had a question. We were talking off the air, and I said, based on, you seem very passionate about a lot of the, well, everything that you're working for in this particular election. And I said, does it ever get frustrating? And you had an interesting response. You said that actually the frustration and some of the things, working with people that may not see things clearly the way you do on those issues, that's what keeps you going.
Yeah, because I wouldn't be motivated to do this simply for some gain, be it personal attention or money or... political power, the latter two, of course, not being forthcoming at all as a result of my efforts. And the first one being much more minimally as far as getting attention. Yeah, I get a little attention. I'm here right now. But generally, a minor party candidate gets pretty heavily ignored by the mainstream. But in a way that helps galvanize my feeling that maybe we're doing something right, and the fact that we get so quickly ignored and dismissed makes me think, you know, it's that old thing of first they ignore you, then they resist you, and then they join you type of approach, that I really am motivated based upon my feeling that I am right. I've taken on a point of view because I was convinced it was the right point of view. It wasn't always my point of view. I was convinced. And ever since then, nothing has refuted what I believe to be true.
Okay. Well, there you are. Let me ask you quickly, since you are very articulate in expressing libertarianism points of view in the party platform, on the November ballot, specifically, there's a constitutional convention proposal, which, by Michigan's state constitution is required to be to give the voters a chance to make a choice to set this up, to supposedly talk about changes to the constitution, and after they work on it for a year or two, then bring it back to the public for a vote. Libertarian Party of Michigan, do they take a position on that, yes or no?
Yes, we did. Actually, a resolution at our most recent convention was against the idea. The reasons that were given in the discussion, and there are a few reasons, but I'm going to give my biggest reason right here, is the legislature has consistently passed a mixed bag of laws that often are popular, often are not, but a lot of times they completely ignore popular sentiment because it's just the popular views may not conform to the establishment views in some areas.
Or some of their lobbyists' views.
Right. And so as a result, we have citizens' initiatives, which by contrast have overridden the will of the legislature and placed changes into the state's constitution by a majority vote. And what makes them different than laws or voting for candidates or political parties is the people are voting directly on a specific law designed to achieve a specific purpose. And so you don't get the mixed bag of, you know, of good and evil, basically, that full of compromises and deals that come out of the legislature. Now, what does that have to do with the Constitutional Convention? What it has to do with that is when delegates are selected for the Constitutional Convention, it'll be a selection process very similar to the way the state legislature is selected by districts, and is very likely to reflect the same ideological and makeup that we have in our state legislature, and therefore would probably be subject to being the same kind of ridiculous outcome, which is we'll probably get a state constitution that will look like it's written by the state legislature and will undo a lot of those citizens' initiatives. So if you voted for yes on any of those citizen initiatives and you hold them sacred, vote no on the Constitutional Convention.
Okay, a couple issues that either might be in the Constitutional Convention or could be done by the legislature and then people vote on up or down. What do you think about term limits? We currently have term limits for office in Michigan, or what does the Libertarian Party think? Have they taken a position on term limits?
I'm not sure if the party's taken a position on term limits recently. I do know a lot of people, for instance, took a position on going unicameral, and that didn't, but that didn't pick up.
Okay.
A lot of people for part-time.
However, there's my part-time legislature is the second issue. Let me just go to the third one here, because I want to give you 3 minutes to sort of summarize why people should vote for you, and in fact, why they should vote for you as Secretary of State if they have libertarian philosophies. And maybe you could also talk Libertarian Party is different than the so-called Tea Party, which is not really a political party, too, but give you a chance to sum up however you want to. What about the Michigan Fair Tax proposals? That isn't on the ballot, but we've talked to some of the people from Michigan Fair Tax and have talked about the national proposal for fair tax. Is that something that has libertarian favor?
Some libertarians are for it. Some are against it. Philosophically, we oppose taxes, to say, do you support the fair tax, is no, we don't support a tax. Now, as a lesser evil argument goes, and we generally don't get big on lesser evils, but as a lesser evil argument goes, I would say at the state level, it may be better, but you'd have to make sure all the other taxes are eliminated. At the federal level, as currently proposed, the fair tax would be useless. And the reason it would be useless is it's supposed to get rid of all hidden taxes, but it would leave intact the Federal Reserve System, which is the biggest hidden taxing tool of all. You could have all the taxes eliminate and go, look, our fair tax is only 5%, and somehow the government's still spending like crazy and everyone's still in a depression. Right. Well, it's going to be because the Federal Reserve is going to replace basically issuing, you know, cheap loans instead of government handouts, and it's costing all of us.
You're probably familiar with just some of our listeners, or I assume readers too, that Ron Paul's book, Representative Ron Paul, who back in the 90s was a libertarian candidate for President of the United States, and the Fed is his most recent book, and that goes into great detail about what those issues are all about. Most people say, well, you got to have a Federal Reserve, but wow, you don't really, and the excesses and the problems and the 2008 crisis, they need to get some background for themselves, as well as about the fair tax. My liking the fair tax, I'm sure with other libertarians, is that nationally it ends IRS. I mean, you don't need the
right.
IRS
and ends the IRS, but then you haven't, you know, and the idea was that, well, if people could just see how big their taxes were, they'd turn against them, but you could still hide the taxes.
Ah, okay. And that's, we'll look at that in the future.
And that's because of the Federal Reserve System is the way you hide the taxes.
Okay,
and so,
good to know. I'm going to look into that myself. We only have a couple of minutes left. We'll give you pretty close to your full 3 minutes, we promised. Why should people vote for you, Scotty Bowman, for Secretary of State on the Libertarian Party candidate list this November?
Well, I wanted to go on a bit about my objection with the Real ID Act specifically and the RFID chips. Other aspects of privacy protection that I also support are the end to storing and stockpiling biometric information, because that can also be used to track people based upon things like facial recognition cameras and limiting the resolution with which ID pictures are shared. So I'm definitely very strongly in favor of protecting privacy. I have actually tried to get some of the other candidates to also agree on some of those points, and I'm in the process. I've had some positive responses from some of them, but I'm not going to come out with a formal statement until I've talked to all of them. And basically working for, as far as a minor party, one thing that hasn't come up in the discussion yet was the issue of how we differ from the major parties in the role of overseeing elections. And the recent flap over the so-called Tea Party, which was a political party named after the Tea Party movement, the Republicans that had decision-making roles, for instance, in the Board of Canvassers, voted right down party lines against it. Democrats in favor of this organization. The Republicans had something to lose by them being on the ballot. The Democrats had something for them to gain by being on the ballot. So I'm not beholden to either major party, whereas a Republican and a Democrat would be. And I think that's another substantial difference between voting for me and a major party candidate.
Okay. Thank you for that summary and just being so articulate about your positions. I love political candidates, and maybe Dennis does too, who speak real sentences, not pre-programmed sound bites. And somebody asked me the other day, Dennis, what's a sound bite? So I you know, we're radio people and media people. We know it's these phrases that they learn and they repeat over and over that don't mean much, but boy, they really sound good. And if they just keep saying those dozen or so phrases, they think that'll help them get elected. And you have been very articulate, didn't repeat any key phrase more than once. So I appreciate that. I think people, if they're really intelligent and smart, that they will find the appropriate words to answer the appropriate question in the right situation, and maybe based on principles, yes.
But well, yes, I do believe in Americanism.
There you go.
And okay. I support we the people.
Well, that's great. And how can people find out more about you? We have to close.
No cliches, though.
Oh, right? Yeah. Please visit. Yeah, I was doing that on purpose.
Okay.
Please visit scottybowman.org, and that's scottybowman.org. There's no W in my name or in my soul.
Okay.
Oh.
But there is in WHFR. We got a W. And it's also mi.lp.org, or if you want Libertarian Party National Office, it's just lp.org. So mi.lp.org. Scotty, your name there as a candidate. They actually have a link to your website from there. So, but thank you for being with us today. Thanks for letting our listeners know about a very valid choice. Once they understand what the issues really are and what the principles are of these candidates, we always encourage you to explore all your choices, all your options. And Libertarian Party has been there consistently for now almost four decades, so not quite, but almost nationally. Thank you for your time today on the new WHFR Journal.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to be concluding the show right now with just a few comments. We have a big presentation tomorrow night. It is fundraiser for WHFR, but we also think it'd be very entertaining. Hey, when was the last time you went to a college lecture at a college campus? Okay. A lecture by Peter Robbins, who is he's going to talk about Britain's best UFO case. That was in 1980 in Rendlesham Forest, a U.S. Air Force base, had unexplained intrusions on their airspace. They had landing of aircraft of some sort. They have witnesses that identified passengers, even, and a massive cover-up ensued. Now, some of the information is coming out, but this is the man, Peter Robbins, who wrote the book, who gathered all the information about the event and the investigation. And he's going to be speaking here tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., right here at Henry Ford Community College main campus, the Andrew Mazzara Conference Center, just immediately south of our Student Center building. Get your GPS going on that on Evergreen Road. 7:30 p.m., $10 per person, $8 for students, and it's co-sponsored by Michigan MUFON, which is the private investigative team, national team that does investigate, even though the government says there's nothing to investigate, on WHFR radio. So that's the end of our show. Stay tuned for Highway 61, The Best in Blues with Joanne Korchinska. This is WHFR.FM. Thanks to our special guests today, Ed Chillens and also Scotty Bowman. Tune in next week for our special Peace Theme Week show. Very special. Peace, what a concept. Take care out there. This is, as I said, WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
The following.